On August 20th, 2015, Wesley Rowe was sitting in his stepdaughter Elizabeth's room discussing her class schedule for the upcoming school year when three loud pops rang through their usually quiet Florida neighborhood. Wesley ordered his stepdaughter to hide in the master bedroom's closet, and he leapt to the window to see what was happening. He heard a woman scream and caught sight of a shadowy figure running between his and his neighbor's house towards the lake behind the neighborhood. Wesley called 911 and told the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department dispatcher that he had heard gunfire on Fensbury Drive in Carrollwood, a small suburb of Tampa. He said the gunfire had sounded like it was coming from the front of his house and that he had seen someone running from the scene.
Yes, we found a gunshot outside our house and I saw someone screaming and running.
Okay, what is the address of your emergency?
It's 1418 Fensbury Drive, Florida.
Is there a lot or an apartment number?
No, this is a house.
And you heard gunshots and screaming?
It sounded like gunshots.
How many gunshots did you hear?
It was two or three.
The dispatcher promised a sheriff's deputy was on the way, and Wesley went downstairs to look out for the officer's arrival. When he peeked out the window in front of his house, he saw shoes and blue jeans in his driveway. He thought that was odd. He then realized that it wasn't clothing someone had thrown away, but a body.
911, what is your emergency?
Yes, I called earlier about gunshots at my house, and it looks like I'm looking out the front yard. It looks like somebody at the end of our driveway got shot or something. They're like laying on the ground.
What is the address of the emergency?
14108 Fensbury Drive. Can we get a deputy here now?
Yes, sir. I'm trying to enter this into the system. How long ago were the gunshots?
I don't know. I called earlier. It was about 4 minutes before I called earlier. I think a deputy's here now.
They are there. Can you see them?
I think so. I don't want to go outside after I heard that. It looks like there might be something. I can't really tell. There might be a body on the ground out here.
Can you see? Are your window open, deputy?
Yeah, I can see the deputy there. I think he's going to check the body.
Okay, is there anybody else around?
No, my daughter's inside the house.
Detective Michael Pekliak was the first officer to arrive at the Fensbury Drive scene. He found a woman's body and two shell casings in Wesley Rowe's driveway. He checked the victim's neck for a pulse, but couldn't find one. She was dead. Officers were worried that there was an active shooter, and they secured the neighborhood. Crime scene tape blocked off the cul-de-sac, and officers fanned out, going door to door, checking in on the neighbor's residence. The door to 14110 Fensbury Drive, where Wesley's next-door neighbors, Miriam and Robert Deans, lived, was open, and officers went into the home looking for other potential victims. The residence was eerily quiet, but it was almost like someone had just been there. There was a bag of Cheetos on a recliner in the living room, and the movie Ex Machina was paused on the TV. Lights were on all over the house. A purse and keys were on a high-top table, but there was no sign that anything was amiss. Towards the back of the house, officers found a locked door, and their first thought was that a suspect may have barricaded themselves in the room. Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department Lieutenant Robert Carr would later say that officers repeatedly gave verbal commands asking that whoever was in the room come out. After no response, officers found a screwdriver and opened the door. A strong odor of decomposition washed over the officers. Lieutenant Carr noticed the smell and then noticed a comforter on the floor and what looked like a human toe protruding from it. He pulled back the comforter and saw that it had been covering a man who appeared to have been dead for several days. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 100. The deceased were quickly identified as 56-year-old Miriam and 67-year-old Robert Deans. They had moved into the Fensbury Drive home 2 or 3 years prior to the murder, and their neighbors described them as quiet but pleasant based off of their limited interactions with them. Miriam was away for work a lot, as she was a nurse and captain in the United States Navy. But neighbors often saw Robert, who was a retired police officer, working outside in their yard. The couple didn't have any kids of their own, but Miriam did have three children from previous relationships. One of them, 21-year-old Nicole Nachtman, had been home all summer on break from Florida State University in Tallahassee. Wesley Rowe and his stepdaughter Elizabeth told police that Nicole had been at the dean's house the day of the murder. They had both seen her doing odd things that day, and the sightings stood out to them as unusual. The dean's house had a side door that faced Elizabeth's bedroom window. Elizabeth had seen Nicole come out the side door and walk down the driveway, which was odd because no one typically used that door. Stranger still, Wesley had seen Nicole outside the side of the house around 7 p.m. that night. She had opened a first floor window from the outside and put some notebooks and books on the sill to prop the window open. Police knew that Robert Deans had been dead for 24 to 48 hours, thanks to surveillance footage from a nearby Publix grocery store, a Pep Boys auto parts, and a China Walk restaurant that accounted for Robert's last movements on August 18th. If Nicole had been at the house on August 20th, police thought she would have been home with Robert's body all day. Detective Mitchell Messer Jr., who has since retired from the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office, was the lead investigator on the case. After a night filled with interviews with the dean's neighbors, Detective Messer called Nicole at school in Tallahassee at 8:26 a.m. on August 21st to tell her about her mother's death. Nicole picked up the phone and told Detective Messer that her uncle had already called her with the bad news. Without prompting, Nicole then told him that she had been at school for a day or two already. Detective Messer said he was sending detectives to talk to her and asked her for her address. She said she didn't know it offhand, that it was a new dorm, but that she knew that it was in the Sally building. Detective Messer asked Nicole to call him back with the address so they could find her when they arrived on campus. Meanwhile, Detective Messer and the other detectives back in Tampa were busy collecting evidence from the dean's home. An autopsy found that Miriam had died of a gunshot wound to the head and the torso. Her forehead was also scraped up. Robert had died of a single gunshot wound to the back of his neck. Both, the medical examiner said, had been shot at close range. Shelby Garman, a crime scene investigator, took 400 photos of the dean's house and found red blood-like substances on the recliner, the refrigerator, and on the washing machine. A load of laundry was still wet in the machine and included a blue and white Titleist baseball cap with a hole in the back, an orange sponge, a plaid shirt, and a pair of stained women's blue jeans. A more mysterious clue was a single bloody fingerprint on a wall near the bedroom where Robert Deans was discovered. Investigator Garman cut out the drywall and marked the fingerprint as evidence. Using amino black and blue star, chemicals that enhance the presence of blood, making it easier for investigators to see, police were able to find traces of blood all over the furniture, the kitchen, the sink's faucet, a mop bucket, and on the walls. The blood later tested positive for Robert Dean's DNA. The scene of Robert's murder had been thoroughly cleaned up with a bottle of bleach from the garage, police said. Officers noted that the home office didn't appear to have been rifled through, and no one had gone through the dean's safes or cars for valuables. It didn't appear that the murders had been a robbery gone wrong or a murder-suicide. Outside in the driveway, investigators found little evidence around the scene of Miriam Deans' murder, other than three shell casings. Police even searched the small lake behind the dean's house for clues, but came up with no leads. The gun used in both shootings was later determined to be Robert Deans' 9mm handgun that he kept at his bedside table. Detective Messer interviewed Miriam Deans's extended family the day after the murders and realized that parts of his conversation with Nicole weren't adding up. Nicole's grandmother had told detectives that her granddaughter hadn't left for college in Tallahassee, but Nicole had been adamant to Detective Messer that she had been on campus for days. Nicole's cousin David also told police that Nicole had come to his house and asked him for money on August 19th, the day before the murders. He told police she hadn't been in Tallahassee and that she hadn't mentioned plans to go back that evening. Nicole hadn't called Detective Messer back after several hours with her dorm address, so he asked if Nicole's uncle, Eric Lair, would call her and check in on a recorded call. During the call, Nicole tells her uncle that she had called the officer back and left a message with the address. He tells her that her mom is gone and that the officers are making it sound as though she had something to do with it. He asks her when she arrived at school, and she says she left around 6 or 7 p.m. on the 19th. She says she will speak to the detectives when they arrive.
Are you alone, Nikki?
Well, I'm outside.
I know, but are you alone?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, because the detective told me he thinks somebody hurt your mom intentionally. Are you listening?
Yeah. Mom does have... Mom doesn't get along as many people as you think.
Mom doesn't get along with as many people as you think, she says. Eric asks Nicole if she's okay. I'm fine, she says, before quickly saying, no, I'm not. Detective Messer arrived in Tallahassee by helicopter around 1 p.m. He searched Nicole's dorm room and her red Toyota Prius. He applied for a warrant to search her phone and her phone company's records, believing that the phone would have search data, messages, and emails that might paint a picture of Nicole's movements before and after her mother's murder. As for the phone company records, Detective Messer hoped they'd find GPS data to track her movements that day and see if she really was in Tallahassee. Nicole's cell phone records showed that she had been in and around Tampa in the 3 days before her mother and Robert's murders. Her cell phone had pinged a cell tower near the Deans' home and only started to ping cell towers around Tallahassee on the morning of August 21st. Her GPS data from her car showed that she had traveled to Tallahassee immediately after Miriam's death. Other records from Nicole's cell phone and laptop showed that she had Googled getting away with murder and dropping out of college. As he waited on this evidence, Detective Messer interviewed Nicole. He asked what she had been doing that day, but Nicole was more interested in talking about Elsa, the main character from Disney's popular animated feature, Frozen. That wasn't the only slightly off thing about Nicole that Detective Messer observed that day. Nicole, he said, was wearing a long black cloak and had a noticeable bad smell, as though she hadn't showered in weeks. Detective Messer said in his initial report that he didn't feel as though Nicole grasped how serious the situation was, and he asked her if she understood that her mother was dead. Later, it would be revealed that Nicole did understand that her mother and stepfather were dead, because just hours before that conversation with Detective Messer, she had confessed to the killings. Nicole's brother, Joseph Carey, had just gotten off a 12-hour shift at his U.S. Air Force job in Tacoma, Washington, when he saw missed calls and messages from his family in Florida. Initially, Joseph was of the understanding that the deaths of his mother and stepfather had been a murder-suicide, not a homicide. He called Nicole, who he said sounded a little upset, and they talked a second time that day, and she said she was going to miss him. He said, "What do you mean?" Then she said, quote, "I killed Mom and Pop." Nicole explained to her brother, whom she called Joey, that she had heard screaming in her head for the last few months. She told him she didn't think she could do it, but she did. After she shot Robert, she said, the screaming in her head went away. Nicole told Joey that she almost drove back to Tallahassee after killing Robert, but she heard a voice telling her that she had almost accomplished her dreams. She took it as a sign from God that she needed to kill her mother as well. She told her brother that she went back to the house and spent the night, lying in wait for her mother. Nicole said she got cold feet the night her mother was expected home, and she jumped out the window to leave. Instead, she ran into her mother in the driveway. "Nikki, what the fuck are you doing here?" she recalled Miriam saying. Nicole said she blacked out, but knew she had killed her mother. Joey reported this conversation to police and told Nicole to ask for a lawyer if and when police arrived to question her. On August 21st, after their interview, Detective Messer arrested Nicole and charged her with 2 counts of murder for the killing of Miriam and Robert Deans. She was arrested in her dorm and brought back to Hillsborough County, where she was held at the Leon County Jail without bond. Initially, the state of Florida wanted Nicole to face 2 separate trials, one for Miriam's murder and one for Robert's. But prosecutors ultimately decided that 1 trial on 2 counts of murder would be sufficient. Nicole's trial began on July 24, 2019, 4 years after the murders, with Assistant State's Attorney John Terry leading the prosecution. Terry's opening statement painted a picture of what had motivated Nicole to commit the murders and tried to make the case that the killings had been premeditated. This was key. In Florida, state law requires that the state must prove that a killing was premeditated in order to convict a defendant on first-degree murder charges. Terry was seeking a conviction on 2 counts of first-degree murder and knew he had to effectively argue that Miriam and Robert Deans' murders were not spur-of-the-moment incidents, but thought out and planned. Terry told jurors that Nicole, despite being a 21-year-old college student, had problems with responsibility and lived in an anime world, spending hours blogging on the platform Tumblr. At the time of the murders, Nicole was scheduled to begin her junior year at Florida State in Tallahassee, Terry said. She had spent a semester abroad studying in London that same year and had returned to the Fensbury Drive house for the summer. Terry described Miriam as a hands-on mother who was very involved in Nicole's life. Miriam had won sole custody when Nicole was 4 years old, and the pair moved around a lot when Nicole was young. But Miriam always provided for her, Terry said, and their big extended family in Tampa was always accessible. Nicole had been a good student in high school and an average student in college. Her sophomore year, her grades then slipped from B's to F's. Sometime over the summer of 2015, Terry said, Nicole learned that she didn't have housing lined up at Florida State. She had forgotten to do the paperwork and didn't have a dorm. Rather than face her mother's anger over the housing situation, Nicole decided to kill her parents, Terry argued.
So we moved to the end of the summer. August 18th, I've told you Miriam Deans leaves to go to Jacksonville. You're going to see a receipt in her car that from the days that she was staying at the hotel in Jacksonville, again, where she was on assignment with the Navy. She left Nicole Notman and her husband Robert Deans at the house at that time. Nicole Notman was supposed to be going back to FSU at this time as well. Classes were about to start. Housing was opening up. Kids were moving in. This was the time of the summer, obviously, when that starts to happen. So in Miriam Deans' mind, Nicole Notman was gone. She was heading back to school while she went to Jacksonville. Robert was home. But unbeknownst to Miriam, at this point in time, Nicole Notman had failed to put in her paperwork. And she had no housing. On August 18th, she had no housing. She did not want to tell her mom. So on August 18th of 2015, this is where Nicole Notman finds herself. Enrolled at FSU, but nowhere to stay. And this, ladies and gentlemen, this is the spot where her plan takes shape.
The plan, Terry said, was to kill Robert while Miriam was in Jacksonville for work. Nicole shot him in the back of the head and killed him instantly, sometime between August 18th and August 19th, he said. He argued that Robert was killed because he was the only person who stood between Nicole and killing her mother. He said she dragged Robert to the spare bedroom, covered him with a blanket, and cleaned his blood off the kitchen floor. On August 19th, Nicole learned that she had a spot in an overflow dorm for the next semester. The university required a $100 deposit and late fee, which Nicole didn't have. Despite receiving a $50 a week allowance, he said, she spent a lot of money and was always short for necessities. Terry said Nicole went to her cousin, David Lair, and borrowed the money from him. When she returned home, she sent off the check and the paperwork, securing her housing for the semester. Despite Nicole's housing situation working itself out, Terry said, Nicole still went through with her plan to kill her mother. She moved her car a few miles north of the home around 5:30 p.m., according to GPS tracking data. At that time, Terry said, Miriam Deans was on her way home from her assignment in Jacksonville, unaware that Nicole wasn't at Florida State, but was waiting for her at the Carol Wood house. The next day, Terry told jurors, Nicole Notman told her brother, Joey Carey, quote, if only I had gotten the good news about the housing, I wouldn't have had to do it. Public defender Julianne Holt led Nicole's defense team and built her case around the argument that Miriam had psychologically and physically abused Nicole. She said Nicole was a broken person who exhibited symptoms of psychological damage and possible schizophrenia. Holt said Nicole had been incapable of navigating any environment since she had been a child. She said close friends and members of Miriam Deans' family had concerns about Nicole's development for a decade before the killing, but no one had the courage to intervene and talk to Miriam. Nicole's parents had broken up when she was a baby. The custody battle over her had been bitter, Holt said, and Nicole had a front seat to the volatile relationship and the numerous verbal and physical altercations. Holt said that witnessing such abuse from a young age could cause long-term psychological damage.
I know it's very hard to ask you to not reach conclusions based on what you have heard, but I want you to understand that it is my intent and that of Ms. Hersey Folguera to provide to you a full picture of Nicole Notman's life so that you will understand how you go from being born and being brought into this world by parents and then ultimately sitting in a courtroom as we are today.
Holt told the jury that they should find Nicole not guilty by reason of insanity. She said Nicole's mental health had been deteriorating, exhibited by her bad hygiene and habit of sleeping in random rooms or bathrooms on Florida State's campus. Nicole was more than just afraid of her mother, Holt argued. She was terrified of her. Holt described how Miriam would call Nicole, yelling, and how Miriam had decided what Nicole's major would be at college. Miriam had forced Nicole to get liposuction, Holt said, even though Nicole was 19 years old and only 130 pounds. Nicole's fear of her mother, Holt said, led her to do irrational things. For example, Nicole had rented a storage locker because she couldn't remember if the bike her mother had bought her had gotten lost or had been stolen. She thought by putting items in storage at Florida State, her mother wouldn't find out about the missing bike and wouldn't get angry. She also changed her grades so her mother wouldn't find out how badly she was doing in college. The week of August 18th, Holt said, Nicole was afraid for her life. She said Nicole thought Miriam would kill her when she found out about her failure to get housing. The abusive circumstances of her relationship with her mother, her lack of a support system, deteriorating mental health, and her fear of being killed led her to kill her mother and stepfather, she argued.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ms. Hersey Folguera and I are convinced that at the end of everything, everything that you are going to hear and see, and in keeping an open mind and keeping to your commitment to follow the law that is supported by the evidence, that you will find that Ms. Nachman was in fact insane at the time of the deaths of Robert and Miriam, and had been abused and battered throughout her childhood and her life.
After both sides' opening statements, trial testimony for the first 2 days largely focused on the results of the crime scene investigations and the testimony of Miriam and Robert's neighbors, Wesley Rowe and his stepdaughter Elizabeth. Investigators were questioned by both Terry and Holt, but the questioning was not very intense, given that Nicole had previously confessed to the murders. Detective Mitchell Messer Jr., the lead detective on the case, spent about 2 hours on the stand discussing the investigation. He was the one who had conducted that bizarre interview with Nicole, where she seemed not to understand what was happening. But Detective Messer's testimony also unearthed a few other details about Miriam and Nicole's relationship prior to the killing. Detective Messer testified that the summer of Miriam's murder, Nicole and her mother had the following text message conversation. Message from Miriam: "You should weigh 100 pounds at 5 feet and add 5 pounds for every inch." Nicole: "Yeah." Miriam: "I want to make sure you go back to school looking good. You are 61 inches. Your weight should be max 105 pounds. No meals after 7 p.m. Eat salad and meat every other day. Stay away from bread." Nicole responded, "Okay." Nicole's defense team honed in on the importance of this text message exchange and said it showed how controlling Miriam was and how unhealthy her expectations were for Nicole. On the third day of the trial, family and people familiar with Nicole started to testify, painting a vivid picture of how fraught her relationship with her mother was. Nicole's cousin, David Lair, testified that she had come over to his house in Tampa on August 19th to borrow $100. She initially told him she needed the money to fix her phone, and David thought nothing of it because Nicole often borrowed money from him. She later told him she actually needed the cash to pay a late fee on her housing application because she had failed to submit the proper paperwork during her last semester. Lair said that, like a lot of kids, Nicole didn't want her mom knowing about everything in her life. Next on the stand were two of Nicole's roommates who had been assigned to live with her in the makeshift dorm shortly before the murders. Petra Henry told the court that she had been assigned to an overflow housing room in Smith Hall, and when she arrived, Nicole was sitting on the top bunk with a blanket wrapped around her shoulders. There were no sheets on the bed, but a suitcase was empty on the floor. Petra said she noticed Nicole, whom she had never met before, looked upset. She asked her what was wrong.
"I noticed that she was upset, so I asked her what was wrong, and she told me her mom just died. And I said, 'Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. What happened?' And she said, 'I don't know. Detectives are flying in later.' And I said, 'Okay, well, I understand if you don't want to be around anybody right now, but my dad and my sister are about to come up here to help me pack my things and move into my permanent dorm.' And she didn't say anything. She just got up and left, and I never saw her again."
Marielle Battle was also assigned to the room with Nicole and testified that Nicole did not arrive to the dorm room until that Friday. But she said Nicole wanted her to tell people something else.
"She had said that she wanted me to say that she had moved in the day before."
"Okay, did she tell you who she wanted you to say that to?"
"I guess if anyone asked."
"All right. Did you find that strange?"
I did. I didn't see anybody asking me, like, that type of question, so I didn't think it was that important.
All right, specifically, she said that if anyone asked you, she was moved in the day before. Is that what she said?
Yes.
Mariel was asked if Nicole ever brought up her mom, and she said yes.
She said to me that her mom was, like, recently in, like, a car accident of some sort. I'm not exactly sure where it happened, but I assumed that it was, like, in her hometown, Tampa.
She said Nicole seemed rather normal, not particularly sad or happy. Jacqueline Roman Eisenman, Nicole's former roommate, testified on the fourth day of the trial via Skype, and she described the frustrations of living with Nicole. She was the defense team's first witness called to the stand. Jacqueline, who was a freshman at the time, said that it was a random roommate match and that things didn't go very smoothly. On move-in day, Nicole was moving in her boxes and luggage by herself. Jacqueline said she thought it was strange that Nicole's parents weren't helping her, especially because Nicole seemed very flustered and overwhelmed by all the work and the hustle and bustle of move-in day. That first day, Jacqueline noticed that Nicole didn't appear or smell clean. She had a smell to her, and she was wearing an old, worn-out pair of sneakers. Stranger still, Jacqueline said, Nicole didn't have any pillows, bedsheets, or pillowcases, and just slept on the Blue University-issued mattress. Jacqueline said she had to use an air freshener to keep their dorm smelling good, because Nicole's body odor and dirty laundry would stink up the small room. Nicole was also messy, Jacqueline said. Her belongings would be strewn across the room, and she wouldn't clean anything. She said she confronted Nicole, but things didn't get better, and so Jacqueline eventually requested a room transfer 3 different times. Jacqueline said Nicole would sleep all day when she wasn't in class and be up all night playing on 2 computers and muttering under her breath. She described how she once found Nicole asleep in the bathroom of a Florida State classroom building. She was lying on the bathroom floor with her backpack under her head, even though their dorm room was just a short walk away. Perhaps the most perplexing thing, Jacqueline said, was Nicole's obsession with Elsa from the movie Frozen. Nicole dyed her hair platinum blonde to look like Elsa and bought coloring books, magazines, clothes, pens, and a purse emblazoned with Elsa's face. Aside from her observations about Nicole's behavior, Jacqueline testified about Nicole's relationship with her mother. She had told Jacqueline that Miriam wouldn't let her be a history major like she wanted to be, but forced her to enroll in the International Relations program because there was a career path. Jacqueline said she knew that Miriam had made Nicole have liposuction that summer. She also testified that she frequently heard Nicole and Miriam arguing over the phone. Her perception was that Miriam was very domineering and Nicole was afraid to stand up to her. Prosecutors tried to downplay Jacqueline's testimony and questioned her on whether Nicole really was abnormal or just not Jacqueline's type of person. They wanted to discount the defense's point that Nicole's inability to take care of herself like a normal student was a sign of mental illness. On another day of the trial, Nicole's closest friend, Laura Hessemer, corroborated much of what Jacqueline told the court. Laura testified that she met Nicole in the spring of 2015, when they were both enrolled in the same history class. Laura said she studied with Nicole and introduced her to her friends because she didn't have any friends of her own.
How did Nicole dress when she was in college?
She dressed in blue jeans, usually a t-shirt with a old windbreaker jacket.
Now the jacket, would she wear it like if it's cold outside and it's December, or did she wear it year round?
All year round, every day.
FSU is obviously in Florida.
Yes.
I'm assuming it's not too much cooler than, let's say, Tampa.
Not by much.
And she would wear this heavy jacket even in the summer months or in the spring when it was hot?
Correct. It would become very smelly.
Did you also see Nicole with weights on her wrists?
Yes.
And what were those for?
She said to work out, to lose weight. Her mother wanted her to lose weight.
When the old jacket Nicole wore for weeks got too smelly, Laura would wash it for her, and she'd encourage Nicole to bathe.
She had a very strong odor. For the longest time, I thought it was because she didn't shower, but it turns out she did not wear deodorant. But whenever she did smell, I would wash her jacket, and I would have her go take a shower.
She said she never knew Nicole to have a boyfriend or any type of meaningful relationship like that. She testified that she knew Nicole didn't ever want to go back home because she was in fear of her mom. On the Monday before the murders, she spoke with Nicole about getting LASIK surgery. She said Nicole was scared about getting it. She also testified about Nicole's obsession with Elsa from Frozen.
She had a imaginative mind. She loved to draw. She loved to write stories. However, she does like horror, so she wrote a lot of fiction horror stories with Frozen Elsa, with another character from a different movie, and she would always pair them up together.
What about her obsession with, like, material things related to Elsa? Dyeing her hair, costumes, things like that?
She didn't dye her hair. She wanted her hair to be like Elsa's. But it got so blonde, I told her she can't go further because it would actually break her hair. She told me her friends helped her with dyeing her hair, but that was when I said, I'm not aware of you having any other friends besides me. And she also actually stitched by hand a whole Elsa outfit so she would wear during Halloween.
The fifth day of Nicole's trial started with the highly anticipated testimony of her brother, Joseph Carey. Nicole had confessed to the murders while talking on the phone with him, and although he was officially a witness for the state, both the prosecution and defense were eager to hear more from him. Joey, as Nicole and his family called him, worked for the United States Air Force, having joined straight after high school. He had had a tough life in many respects. Joey testified that his father committed suicide in 2015, the same year Nicole killed his mother. And in 2003, he and Nicole lost their brother Kevin in a tragic car accident. Joey told the court he had had a tumultuous childhood. His mother, Miriam, had moved the family around a lot, and Joey had been unhappy about all the changes, particularly when he was a teenager. When he was in high school, he told the defense, he actually had left Miriam's home in Texas and moved back to Tampa to live with his grandmother. Joey had witnessed several physical altercations between Miriam and Nicole's biological father, Ronald Nachman. About half of Joey's testimony during the trial centered around Nicole's confession to him. He said that he had called her because he was worried that she was alone and not doing well with the news. He thought she would probably be trying to get home from her school in Tallahassee and wanted to check in on her. Nicole sounded a little upset on that first call, he said. She had already been given the news from the family. He hung up with her so he could purchase a plane ticket home. They spoke again about 15 minutes later. He said she sounded normal, but then she said something strange.
You know, I started off with a normal chit-chat. You know, love you, we'll see you soon. And then she just was quiet for a second, and then she said, I'm going to miss you, Joey.
Just like that, just very matter-of-fact, yep. I'm going to miss you, Joey?
Yep.
All right. What did you think when you heard her say that?
I didn't know what she meant the first time she said it. And I don't think I made sense of it just yet. And I said, what? You know, something like, say that again or what? She's like, I'm just going to miss you. And I said, what do you mean? And then at this point, saying it out loud sounds weird, but I was thinking maybe she was thinking of hurting herself because her mom's gone. So, but I didn't want to put words in her mouth. And I was like, what do you mean? She's like, want to say I said, are you thinking you're hurting yourself now at this point? And she said, no, I don't think I'd do that. And I said, so what do you mean by that? And then she got quiet again. And then she says, I shot him. I said, you did what? Like, I shot Mom and Bob. I said, and I remember leaning forward on the couch and saying it again. I was like, what do you mean you shot Mom and Bob? I said, why'd you do that? Or something to that effect. And she just started crying really bad and talking really fast. And I couldn't understand what she was saying. I was trying to calm her down. And eventually I was trying to get her to calm down and make sense of what she's saying. And eventually she got to the point where she was explaining that ever since she got back from London, her school trip, that she's had uncontrollable screaming in her head and like a high-pitched screaming, and that it was affecting her sleep and she was having nightmares from it. And then I tried to calm her down some more, and then she said, if I had only gotten the good news phone call about the dorms earlier, I wouldn't have had to do it. And I didn't know what she meant by that. I didn't know anything about the dorm situation. I didn't know what she was meaning by that. And then she said something that I remember was, I'm sorry I had to do it, but I'm not sorry that I did it, but I'm sorry I had to do it.
She then started whispering.
What did she tell you specifically about shooting Bob?
She said, and then she went into like a whisper, and she was like, I didn't think I could do it, Joey. I didn't think I could do it, but I shot Bob. I didn't think I could do it. And it was just weird because it was in a whisper and almost sounded like she was proud of herself.
She told him that after she shot Bob, that a lot of the screaming in her head went away. But then she heard voices telling her that her dreams were almost realized and to keep going. She said she took that as a sign from God to go back and finish the job.
So then she told me she went back to Tampa and she waited in the house overnight for my mom. And then when my mom got home, she said that she got cold feet the last second. She wanted to get out of the house. So she mistimed it. She jumped out of the window to not meet my mom. So my mom was walking in the house and she wanted to jump out the window and just time it to where she would miss her. And she mistimed it and ran into my mom. And she said, my mom said, Nikki, what the fuck are you doing here? And she said she blacked out and somehow she knows she did it. And then I don't remember if she said she was in the car driving or she was getting to the car to drive away.
Did she ever mention anything about you calling her an animal or something along those lines?
She said, you can call me a beast, but don't call me a monster or something like that.
Joey broke down in tears on the stand when he testified that he had told Nicole that she could have gone and told anybody about her housing situation, that she didn't have to kill her parents. You had options, he remembered telling her. Why did you have to do that? He said Nicole was crying by then. Joey said he hung up the phone with her after the confession and called his uncle.
Then I hung up and called my family back to find out. I remember saying, like, are we angry at her? Are we trying to help her? What do we, help me think straight. What do I do? And I think I was talking to my Uncle Kenny, and it was either my Uncle Eric or Kenny, I can't remember, but they talked about it for a while and they said, we're going to try and help her.
He then called Nicole back and told her to tell the police when they arrived at her dorm room that she wanted a lawyer. He told her that he loved her and he wasn't sure when he'd see or talk to her again. The defense questioned Joey about his relationship with his mother and Miriam's parenting style. During his responses, Joey testified that Miriam was very tough on her kids and that she'd belittle them at times and call them a disgrace. She had high expectations, and Joey said Nicole was always afraid of letting her mother down and of failing. Nicole was very obedient, he said, and did whatever Miriam told her. When Joey was 15 and Nicole was 3, he said he ran away and went to go live with his grandmother. He never lived with Miriam again. Nicole had been a happy, normal kid up until about the 6th grade, Joey said. Then she became introverted and shy around 11 years old and started dressing more conservatively and often escaped to her room to play on her computer or draw. He could only recall that she had one good childhood friend, and he said he interpreted her withdrawn behavior as a sign of low self-esteem. Joey had suggested to Miriam that Nicole seek counseling, but Miriam had brushed it off, as she had when other family members or teachers had made the same suggestion.
Is it fair to say when your mom wanted your sister to do something, she did it?
Yes.
Was your sister someone who was good at speaking up or going against your mom, or would do as your mom said?
Usually just do what my mom said.
Did the phrase, don't tell mom, become a common phrase your sister used with everybody? You, the family, don't tell mom.
I don't want to say common, but she's told me a couple times, don't tell mom about whatever.
As far as your mom's behavior towards your sister when it came to her weight or her appearance, you're aware that your mom had your sister get liposuction?
Yes.
And that was not because your sister was, like, grossly obese and weighed 300 pounds. Your sister's never been grossly obese, correct?
No.
Your mom made your sister get LASIK? Or was about to make her get LASIK?
She wanted her to get LASIK, yeah.
And as far as you understood, your sister was extremely nervous, scared, and not really wanting to get LASIK.
Yeah, she didn't want anything touching her eyes.
During high school, Nicole's situation got worse. He said it seemed like her relationship with Miriam had gotten worse, too. Miriam had even asked Joey to take Nicole in so she could finish high school where he lived in New York. When Joey refused, he and Miriam didn't speak for several years.
Now, as far as your sister attending Florida State, based on the observations you had seen up to that point of Nicole, when you would visit, she's 18, getting ready to graduate high school and going off to college. From what you could observe, was she somebody who was capable of caring for herself away at school, alone, without any supervision?
No.
Was she someone who knew how to pay bills?
No.
Have the electricity turned on?
No.
Someone who could function in adult daily life up at college by herself?
No.
The times that she would visit you, would you have to actually tell her when to take a shower?
Yes.
And if you didn't, she would go days without showering?
Yes.
Joey also had a unique perspective because he had spent 3 weeks with Nicole the summer before the murders, when she had traveled to Tacoma to visit him. During that visit, Nicole told Joey a few things that indicated she wasn't adjusting well to college life. She said she had been having trouble sleeping and had been experiencing nightmares for 2 years. She also expressed concerns about being bullied at school, as her previous roommates had thrown her mattress into the dorm hallway several times. While Nicole was in Washington, Joey said she wasn't bathing unless he instructed her to, and she'd leave the house in the middle of the night and walk down the road to buy junk food. She would then hide the wrappers at Joey's house, even though he would tell her that it was okay to eat snacks. Nicole's attorney asked him if it's true that after the murders, Nicole was acting like she didn't understand the gravity of the situation. Joey agreed. During his testimony, the defense team played a video recording of Nicole and Joey's first visit after her arrest. In the video, Nicole is dressed in her prison-issued orange jumpsuit, grins from ear to ear, and giggles as she talks to her brother from the other side of a plexiglass divider. She tells Joey that she's doing pretty well, eating 3 times a day and sleeping better than ever. She says she's less worried and anxious, and that she weighs herself daily without fear or apprehension about the number on the scale. In the video, Nicole coos over her nephew starting pre-K and asks if he's into superheroes at all. When Joey says no, he's not interested in superheroes, Nicole smiles, laughs, and says, I know who my favorite superhero is, you.
I want to ask you about the portion, if you recall, about her telling you when she gets out what she was going to do for you and your family.
Yes.
What do you recall her saying?
From the video?
Yes.
She was going to buy us presents and get a job and, yeah, basically that.
So even a week or two up until after her arrest, she still thinks she's at some point going to get out and be able to still interact with the family and
yes.
be in society, basically.
Yes.
Judge Christopher Sabella dismissed jurors on the fifth day of the trial to hear testimony from Nicole's biological father, Ronald Nachman. Ronald was one of the defense's witnesses, but Judge Sabella was worried that his testimony might not be relevant to the case. His testimony was expected to bolster the defense's case that Miriam had been an abusive parent to Nicole. Ronald Nachman, a professor, met Miriam in 1993 playing volleyball in a singles league through their church in Houston, Texas. Unbeknownst to Ronald, Miriam was going through a divorce, but by April, she had moved into his apartment and was pregnant with Nicole. Everything seemed to be fine, Ronald said. They went out a lot, golfed, went fishing, and took beach vacations together. But when they moved into a rental house and Miriam's boys, Joseph and Kevin, moved in, things changed. Ronald claimed that Miriam had flown off the handle several times and accused him of abuse. He said she had also been physical with him, pushing him and punching him on more than one occasion. By that September, Ronald had moved out. When Nicole was born on February 11th, Ronald moved back in with Miriam and took care of her every day while Miriam worked. Miriam and Ronald engaged in a bitter custody battle for Nicole for the first few years of their daughter's life. Ronald wanted some custody rights, but Miriam wanted sole custody and would often block him from coming for his court-ordered supervised visitations. Ronald saw Nicole for the last time when she was 4 years old, but he told the court that he never once gave up trying to have a relationship with her. When she was arrested, he said, he started sending her postcards every day and has replenished her prison commissary accounts. After Ronald's testimony, the jury was allowed back into the courtroom for the rest of the trial. His testimony about the abuse he claimed to suffer at Miriam's hands was not allowed in. The final 2 days of Nicole's trial were focused entirely on testimony from psychiatrists who either interviewed or observed Nicole after her arrest. Both the defense and prosecution, in their rebuttal case, called in special experts to testify, hoping to bolster their respective cases. The first to testify was Dr. Kathleen Heide, a criminologist and licensed mental health worker who specialized in treating juveniles and young adults charged with serious crimes. Dr. Heide, who was a witness for the defense, said she interviewed Nicole 13 times in the 4 years between her arrest and the murder trial. She said her first interview and evaluation of Nicole was on August 28th, about a week after the murder. She spoke with Nicole for 6.5 hours that day and immediately observed that Nicole was in a suicide gown because jail staff were concerned that she would possibly harm herself. During that first conversation, Dr. Heide said Nicole was aware that she was in jail and she knew why she was there. She said Nicole also knew what day it was and that she had been charged with 2 counts of murder. Dr. Heide's preliminary impression of Nicole was that she seemed a bit depressed, but also very animated.
She was depressed when I first saw her. She wasn't sobbing, but you could tell by the affect. She looked very sad. And then what I noticed, and this is very interesting and very important in diagnosis, the affect changed. At times, she was somber, which you would expect, this very serious situation. But then she went from being somber to being animated. And I remember as I was there for 6.5 hours, I couldn't help but notice at times it was like she was a little child, giddy. She even told me some jokes which weren't funny, but more importantly, it's completely inappropriate. This is a 21-year-old who's been charged with 2 serious crimes, and she's like a little kid telling jokes to me. And she knew, by the way, that I was a doctor and why I was coming in and that I would report to the defense. So she was aware of that. So I noticed this very kind of giddy child. Then she became almost like an adolescent, very animated, telling me about anime and the stuff she did, like we were kind of best friends. Then at times she started to stutter and she became very anxious. So I saw those particular types of behavior, which were kind of, if you want to say, you might use the word bizarre because of the context. This is very serious, as we all understand. And she's at times being very childlike and like forgetting or just being unaware or just not plugged into what we're talking about here is very, very serious.
Dr. Heidi said Nicole did have trouble answering basic questions about herself, like where she went to school, without elaborating with unnecessary details. At other times, Dr. Heidi said Nicole would go off on tangents and wouldn't seem capable of returning to the initial subject matter. To Dr. Heidi, this signified a disturbed thinking process. She said Nicole exhibited signs of poor long-term memory. For example, she was unable to recall any memories of her brother Kevin, who had died when she was 10 years old. Dr. Heidi also said that Nicole did not seem to grasp that she was in a really serious situation. That, combined with the disturbed thinking process and the inability to recall memories, was indicative of a clear mental illness, she said. Dr. Heidi also reviewed police video footage of their first interviews with Nicole and said it was obvious she was disassociating during those conversations. Nicole sat in the interview room, picking at her skin, telling jokes, and discussing anime characters or Elsa like they were real. During her testimony, Dr. Heidi tried to make the case that Nicole suffered from delusions. She said in a second interview, Nicole told her that she feared her mother was going to kill her over the housing issue, which was obviously an irrational delusion. Nicole also spoke with Dr. Heidi about how the shooting of her stepfather, Robert, had been covered up by thunder, which she thought was a sign from God that God was protecting her. These were all signs of delusional thinking, Dr. Heidi said. She believed Nicole had been experiencing a psychotic break during the shootings and was also exhibiting symptoms that fit with schizophrenia diagnosis. Dr. Heidi told the court that she believed Ronald Nachman, while not formally diagnosed, also demonstrated signs of schizophrenia. Dr. Heidi didn't just testify about her diagnosis of Nicole. She said Nicole had told her that she didn't feel safe around Miriam and that she had been abused by her mother. During their interviews, Nicole told Dr. Heidi about several violent incidents that had occurred during her childhood. In one, Nicole said her mother kicked her for walking like a boy. In another, she accused Miriam of smashing her head on a table for bad handwriting. She also said Miriam once pushed her into a wall out of frustration when Nicole couldn't understand her homework. Dr. Heidi said she found very limited instances of physical abuse, however, but plenty of evidence of emotional abuse and neglect. While Nicole told Dr. Heidi about the abuse, she had also said that she felt properly cared for and always had what she needed. But still, Nicole said she didn't feel safe when her mom was home and lived in fear of her mother's anger. Nicole told Dr. Heidi that her mother frequently called her an overweight skank and a retard. During her evaluation, Dr. Heidi researched Nicole's school records and said there was evidence that Miriam neglected her daughter. When Nicole was in the third grade, she was evaluated for emotional, behavioral, and cognitive issues after having trouble functioning in the classroom setting. The report stated that she had come to school hungry and tired, which suggested neglect. Files from the Air Academy boarding school, where Nicole attended 8th and 9th grades, showed that teachers had asked Miriam to get Nicole a psychological evaluation. The evaluation was never completed, and Nicole continued to perform at low academic standards and to isolate from social situations. Dr. Heidi said that even at 21, Nicole was impaired and could not function at a basic level. For a college student, Dr. Heidi said it was alarming how ill-equipped Nicole appeared to be to take care of herself. She argued that this could be due to significant trauma experience at the hands of Miriam's parenting style. She said she would classify Nicole as a battered child because there was extreme psychological abuse. During cross-examination, the state grilled Dr. Heidi on her diagnosis. Prosecutors questioned the level of abuse Nicole faced, and Dr. Heidi said the level of abuse and trauma she suffered was possibly not on the level of battered child syndrome. The state also asked if there were any reports from schools or hospitals about physical abuse. Dr. Heidi said that no, there were no hospital reports, no police reports, and no witnesses to the alleged abuse. When asked how Nicole would have suffered a semester abroad in London, as she had earlier in the year, if she was so impaired or mentally ill, Dr. Heidi answered that it was possible that she was able to get by in London with assistance from others. Prosecutors had Dr. Heidi read several text message exchanges between Miriam and Nicole that were loving and supportive in tone. In one message, Nicole asks for more money, and Miriam deposits some into her account right away. In another exchange, Miriam refuses to let Nicole drive home from college for spring break because her car needed maintenance and Miriam was worried for her safety on the road. "Does this sound like a mother who doesn't care about their child?" Terry asked. After Dr. Heidi's testimony, the defense called Dr. Charles Ewing, a forensic psychologist. Dr. Ewing said he also believed that Nicole was mentally ill at the time of the killings, but he had made his report independent from Dr. Heidi's analysis. Like Dr. Heidi, Dr. Ewing had also reviewed thousands of pages of documents about Nicole and had interviewed her several times. He said that he didn't believe Nicole knew that what she was doing at the time of the murders was wrong and didn't understand the consequences of her actions. He described Nicole's view of the world as very black and white. She thought in only negative terms, Dr. Ewing said, and was convinced that people were out to get her. "She was in a psychotic state," Dr. Ewing said. "Her reality testing was extremely poor. She had no present capacity to think in rational terms. She was acting irrationally in a psychotic state." The state's final witness was forensic psychiatrist Dr. Emily Lazzaro. Dr. Lazzaro had an entirely different evaluation of Nicole. She said Nicole knew very well what she was doing when she killed her mother and stepfather. She pointed to Nicole's interactions with her other family members before and after the crime to show how she wasn't having a psychotic break. None of Nicole's family had observed anything out of the ordinary about her behavior before or after the murders. Quote, "She was actively speaking with her family members during the commission of this crime. Saw her cousin, David Lair, after she killed her father and was planning to kill her mother. There was no indication from David that she was acting out of sorts or being psychotic." Dr. Lazzaro told the jury that she didn't believe Nicole was insane at the time of the murders, and she also disagreed with Dr. Heidi's conclusion that Nicole was suffering from symptoms of schizophrenia or psychosis. Dr. Lazzaro said that Nicole didn't report any specific delusions or hallucinations that would be indicative of schizophrenia. Furthermore, Dr. Lazzaro said, asking her cousin David for money requires executive functioning, a skill that requires flexibility, self-control, and a working memory, all things that evaporate with schizophrenia. Instead, Dr. Lazzaro diagnosed Nicole with an adjustment disorder with depressed mood, avoidant personality disorder, schizotypal personality disorder, and borderline personality disorder. Adjustment disorders, Dr. Lazzaro explained, occur when individuals are suffering from stress and begin to feel overwhelmed by life. An avoidant personality disorder is characterized by low self-esteem. Nicole exhibited many symptoms of both. As for schizotypal personality disorder, Nicole exhibited the symptoms of severe social anxiety and disordered thinking, Dr. Lazzaro said. According to her, Nicole also showed signs of 6 out of the 9 criteria used to diagnose borderline personality disorder, as she viewed the world in black and white was often impulsive and had no sense of self. While so much of the defense's argument hinged on Miriam's abusive parenting style, Dr. Lazzaro testified that she didn't feel that Nicole exhibited signs of being a battered child. Like Dr. Heidi, Dr. Lazzaro found limited instances of physical abuse and noted that most cases of battered child syndrome are the result of regular and protracted abuse, not a few violent incidents. Dr. Lazzaro did acknowledge that Miriam had an unconventional and perhaps unloving parenting style, but said it did not equate to psychological or emotional abuse.
Are all parents super affectionate with their children?
No, and it's different. I mean, I don't want to say she wasn't affectionate because Joe told me, you know, that she hugged them and stuff like that. And, you know, I was told that by the grandmother also. But she wasn't overly affectionate. She wasn't a lovey-dovey mom. You know, she wasn't hugging and giving bear hugs and kisses and stuff like that. But again, not everybody does that. But that doesn't mean that you're a bad parent or you're an abusive parent because you're not lovey-dovey. It just doesn't. She had a different style. She's a military officer, and she just had a different style.
During Dr. Lazzaro's testimony, she dismissed the idea that Nicole was afraid for her life and said that she only said that in an attempt to beat the murder charges. Dr. Lazzaro said Nicole had showed many signs of being aware that what she was doing was wrong, including searching for people in low places and bad areas in Tampa on Google after Robert's murder. She also pointed out how she told her brother Joey that she would miss him, a clear sign that Nicole understood the consequences of her actions. Dr. Lazzaro was cross-examined by Nicole's public defender, Julianne Holt, for hours. Holt questioned Dr. Lazzaro's credentials and past work experience, which included earning more than $500,000 testifying as a witness for the state. Holt went after Dr. Lazzaro's assessment of Miriam's parenting style, asking repeatedly whether a parent who slammed their child's head against the table or kicked them for walking like a boy should be reported for abuse.
Dr. Lazzaro.
Yes.
Nicole Nachman has never in her life been obese, correct?
I don't know that. Well, she was,
Was she obese at the time that her mother had her have liposuction against her will?
I don't know what her weight was at the time.
132 pounds.
I would say she was overweight, but not obese.
Do you feel that liposuction against someone's will is something that should happen because you want them to look different?
No, but Nicole did not tell me that that was what happened.
But you've had significant records, including a 52-page report from Dr. Heidi, where all sorts of things were spoken about, correct?
Correct. But
let me ask you this, ma'am. You wear glasses, correct?
Yes, I do.
By choice.
100%. But, well, I mean, I need glasses, yeah. I mean, they're bifocals. I need them, yeah.
And, again, Nicole expressed to you the fear she had about having anyone touch her eyes, do anything.
Yes.
May seem trivial to some people, but for Nicole, that was a real fear, correct?
That's right.
And again, because her mother wanted her to look a certain way, that was going to have to be the choice that Nicole had to live with, correct?
I wouldn't say it was just due to looks. There were other practical things that even Nicole had talked to me about that were talked about in relation to the surgery.
Whatever the practical things were, the bottom line is Nicole did not want the surgery in fear, correct?
That's right.
And at 25 years of age, at 21 years of age, I'm sorry, again, she's an adult, and because her mother wants something, she has to do it. You acknowledge that the mother was controlling?
I do believe she was controlling because she felt that she had to be because she didn't feel that Nicole could handle things without her intervention.
How does liposuction help or LASIK help Nicole with her hygiene?
I don't believe that either of them help. Well, I mean, the LASIK could help with hygiene. You don't have to deal with the glasses, but I don't believe that that was the reason for those.
How does liposuction or LASIK surgery in any way help her navigate better at Florida State University in terms of not sleeping all day, being on a computer all night, and missing classes? How do either of those two things help her in that area?
Her mom didn't know about that. Nicole's covering up her grades. She was telling her everything was fine.
Hygiene was consistent for how many years? And what you're suggesting here today is that the mother did not in any way know about the hygiene problem?
I don't know how she looked whenever she was with her mother. I really don't. I do know that when she was not with her mother, when she was at college, that's when it seemed to be the worst, when there was nobody overseeing her.
After Dr. Lazzaro's testimony, the state rested their case and delivered their closing arguments. Prosecutors Courtney Hansen-Derry and John Terry reiterated the state's position that Nicole had planned the murders in order to avoid facing her mother's disappointment over her housing situation.
And there's no evidence whatsoever that the mother did anything to give her a reason to believe she was in fear of death or great bodily harm. Nothing. She didn't want the repercussions of her mom yelling at her, mad at her because she didn't do what she was supposed to do with the housing. It's had nothing to do with her fear of death, great bodily harm. And there is no evidence, ladies and gentlemen, not a scintilla, not even a single piece of evidence to show any sort of aggressive action on the part of Miriam Deans. Nothing. Self-defense doesn't apply here. Not even at all. It's not even a close call.
Derry described how Nicole had shot Robert execution style in the back of the head on August 18th, sometime after he was last seen at the Pep Boys auto shop, the China Walk restaurant, and the Publix supermarket. She then dragged his 6'3", 200-pound body into the back bedroom, covered him in a blanket, and locked the door. She did laundry, Derry said, and cleaned. The next day, after talking with her mom and saying she was already at Florida State University and had met her new roommates, she found out that she was assigned housing. She went to get money from her cousin and sent in the contract. At this point, the state argued, she could have driven the 4 hours to Tallahassee, but instead, Nicole had planned to kill her mother, so she waited in the Fensbury Drive house. After the murders, Derry said, Nicole called her friend Laura Hessemer and thanked her for being a good friend. She knows exactly what she has done, Derry said. The prosecution reminded the jury that while Miriam wasn't a perfect parent, she did not deserve to be murdered. In the defense's closing arguments, they asked the jury to consider Nicole's mental health situation during deliberations. Nicole's defense team argued that a happy, loved individual would not shoot their parents, and that she clearly suffered from a mental illness that had clouded her judgment and rationale.
The state tried to paint a picture, and I emphasize the word tried, of a happy home in Carrollwood that involved a roof, a pool, shelter, food, material things. But the picture that was painted and supported by the evidence was that of a very different environment. The accurate picture that was painted during this trial, documented by family members, documented by teachers and school psychologists, testified to by people who encountered Nicole Nachman in college, people who saw Nicole on a daily basis and made observations throughout her entire life. And the accurate picture that was painted in this trial is an environment that was riddled with abuse, primarily psychological abuse, which impacted Nicole Nachman and led to her developing a severe mental illness.
She said that all three psychiatrists and medical professionals who testified found that Nicole exhibited symptoms of schizophrenia. She included Dr. Lazzaro's testimony, even though she had diagnosed Nicole with schizotypal personality disorder, which is different from schizophrenia. The mental illness, coupled with years of abuse at the hands of Miriam, including the forced liposuction and the insults like overweight skank, the defense argued, pushed Nicole to act out on her delusion. Following the closing arguments, Hillsborough Circuit Judge Christopher Sabella gave the jury their instructions. 12 hours later, the jury returned with their unanimous verdict. After the two-week-long trial, the 12 jurors, 5 women and 7 men, found Nicole guilty of both counts of murder. Judge Sabella sentenced Nicole on the spot to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Nicole, clad in a baggy white t-shirt and gray cardigan, showed no emotion during the sentencing and just looked at the table in front of her. She didn't offer a statement at the end of the trial and kept her head down as the bailiffs escorted her out of the courtroom. And that's all for today's episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think. Do you think the jury got it right? Was Nicole Nachman the premeditated killer the state painted her as? Or was she triggered by an undiagnosed mental illness and years of abuse? You can let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. Today's episode was researched and written by Kathleen McWilliams. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.